Hello and welcome to The Dirt, a podcast about archaeology, anthropology, and our shared human past. I'm Anna.
And I'm Amber.
And I'll cut this if the timing isn't right, but hey, do you listen to the show? Do you like the show? You can subscribe over on Captivate. There's going to be a link in the show notes. And for just $5 a month, you have access to all of our back catalog of bonus episodes, which spans days. And you can also listen to the sweet, sweet new content that we've got coming up. It's going to be good, I promise. And also, when you subscribe, we get a little warm tingle in our hearts.
Our listeners outside North America have likely missed out on the real or manufactured eclipse mania that is ramping up in anticipation of April 8th, which is the Great North American Eclipse.
TBD and, whether it's great or not.
That's just what it's called. That's what it's called because this is one where the path of totality cuts across North America. I'm going to get to see it at like about 95% because I'm going home. So
I'll
be there. And there is a telescope with the proper fitting on it because as you of the show might remember, my dad has built telescopes and
lens head.
Yeah. And I'm a second generation amateur space guy.
Yeah.
A university bought one of his telescopes off of him. So I think he's technically a professional space guy.
Yeah, I think that gives him his bona fides.
Yeah. And so, so there have been headlines about how like the Federal Aviation Administration has issued warnings about it.
Don't fly into the sun?
I don't know. Well, I haven't clicked on those.
Okay. Or maybe it's like, don't try to see it from.
But also, schools are closing.
Oh, well, that's interesting.
One school had a relatively good argument saying that the totality was scheduled to happen right around the time of dismissal and it would be a disaster. Like for
kids
like,
would all just immediately
people who have been driving for 16 minutes being like, oh, so yeah, like bad news for like traffic and
yeah, okay, that, you're right, that does that
Other
does seem responsible,
maybe a little, not so much. But Anna, do you know what's actually involved in an eclipse?
I do because great. We're doing a special Brains On event and episode about eclipses.
Did you know this before that?
Yeah, I did.
Okay. Well, that's fine. Okay. So, pop quiz, what is it?
I mean, I think I know. Now that you've asked me so aggressively, I am starting to second guess myself, but it's our friend the moon getting in the way is basically what's happening. So, we are orbiting the sun, the moon is orbiting us, and every so often all of those things cross paths so that the moon stands between some portion of the earth and the sun and casts a shadow on the sun. And if it's a total annular solar eclipse, is that the right word?
I need you to finish the sentence before I know if you're right or not.
It's where
that is one of the words for it.
There's an
partial,
annular
and total.
Okay, so partial, yeah, okay. So annular is when there's a ring of light around the shadow of the moon, and then total is it all go dark.
Yeah. So the, yes, that is what it is, and great. Yes, you're correct.
Thank you for writing in the script. Yeah. Like,
I was just
presupposing that I would.
Well, no,
know.
I was going to let it be like, well, you also see, yeah, and then me in mechanism of eclipse, because I was planning to like compliment sandwich
yeah.
you.
Yeah, hedge your bets.
Sure. So, remember, everyone, that in this equation, the sun is not going in a circle, it's just doing its thing. We are
shining.
Going around the sun. Mm-hmm. And so we are, it looks to us as though the sun is moving along the ecliptic because we are moving around it. We're about 6 degrees off, like the the plane that we're going around the sun is a few degrees off from the plane on which the moon is going around us.
Oh, okay. So yeah, they crisscross slightly if you were to imagine them as like
and
plates.
And that's why, depending on where it is, when it is, it is, you don't see a complete eclipse. If there is a complete eclipse, there's this really incredible moment as it falls into place and then comes away where you see the, I think it's Bailey's beads. And these are little, little brilliant like cuts of light that come through the sun shining around the terrain of the moon. So you see like a sunrise on the moon. And you also have the diamond ring effect. That's something that I think is like a quite famous image that people have of total eclipses, where you'll have what looks like a ring or rings like that, instead of shining from the side of it. What the exact term for three or more objects in a line that would, well, I guess two even, that's called a syzygy.
It was one of my favorite words as a kid, just because it doesn't have the regular vowels, just Y's.
Yeah, so it's a, yeah, that is a Greek word. It's also an episode of the X-Files. But a syzygy is the straight line in which planetary objects are aligned that would cause that shadow effect. I saw you look up something. Did you want to contribute?
No, I wanted to see if I could see images of Bailey's beads.
Aren't they nice?
It's neat. Yeah. And I spelled it wrong. There is no E. I spelled it like, you know, the Irish cream.
It looks like Bialy's beads if you well, read it quickly.
Yeah. Ooh, delicious.
But today, Anna, we're going to get our little pinhole cameras and safely look at the back of them, at the relationship between people. You know what I'm talking about?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. There was an eclipse when I was like in second grade and we made them.
Yeah. I know not everybody has like a telescope with the appropriate filter on it.
So yeah, no, we had index cards.
At that sun. Yeah. But we're gonna safely look at the relationship between people and solar eclipses, as well as a roundup of some of the best known eclipses of the past few thousand years. Let's get into it. Anna, guide us into the realm of folklore.
Yes. Here we go. So even though only those along a specific path can see any given eclipse, because it depends on where sun is and where moon is, there is no place on Earth for which there has never ever been an eclipse visible. So it should come as no surprise that people... Yes?
There is an incredibly helpful illustration of this on Wikipedia, where it's a map of an overlay of all eclipses that everything.
Oh, cool.
It's just just blue.
Redacted.
I'm just like, oh.
Oh, okay. Yeah. It's all of it.
Helpful map.
Huh? Cool. So it should come as no surprise that people all over the world throughout time have developed stories to explain what happens during an eclipse and what it means for the observer. In the 1950s, the phenomenally named American folklorist Stith Thompson published an exhaustive 6-volume index of elements of global folklore with the equally exhaustive title Motif Index of Folk Literature, a classification of narrative elements in folktales, ballads, myths, fables, medieval romances, exempla, fabliau, jest books, and local legends. Oh, Stith. Snappy titling. Within that Revenge of the Stith, within that index, entry A737 and sub-entries all pertain to the phenomenon of eclipses and their causes. The most common motif cited is eclipse caused by monster devouring sun. Oh, spicy. Which makes reference to stories collected by folklorists working in Iceland, Finland, Siberia, Yugoslav, that's a fun spelling of that, Armenia, Indonesia, Tahiti, South American indigenous groups, including the Chiriguano, Mokovi, Manasi, Guarayu, Guayaki, Toba, Abipon, Taco, Vilela, Eastern Brazil, and Tucuna. Or possibly Tucuna. Was there a...
Tucuna. It auto-corrected the...
Okay, sorry.
Out of...
the Enya?
Yeah. I don't know what that's called.
I believe it's called an Enya.
Sail away.
No. Or in Nyoko flow. Oh, no. Sorry to...
Off the track, well, off the album, Shepherd Moonies. Okay, go on.
Yeah, I'm so sorry. Okay. I just feel like a damp washcloth. Okay. Other motifs indexed include several sourced to India. All of it. Including a toad being responsible for it. No further detail.
In the index.
Yeah. Huh. Or the ghosts of the sun's children returning, possibly having been cursed or murdered. I like the toad better.
Yeah.
It's less scaly. Some stories indexed from indigenous communities in South America include the Baikairi and Lule stories describing it as an animal hiding the sun behind his back. The Botocudo story that eclipses are the result of fights between the moon and the sun, or the Kavinya and Tumupasa story that an eclipse happens when the sun is in mourning and thus smears darkness onto its face. Huh. I like that.
But yeah, I thought that was quite nice.
Neat.
It's like beautiful. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Striking. Certainly. Mm-hmm. Affecting. Other ways that people have conceptualized the action of an eclipse is to depict the sun and moon as lovers or siblings.
Or both.
Yeah. Who periodically collide out of love or conflict. A story told by the Fon people in Benin in West Africa described the sun and moon as a man and woman who have the all too relatable experience of loving each other very much, but who never seem to have enough time for each other in their busy lives. They're each very career driven. The sun runs the day and the moon manages the night, but they meet up whenever they have a chance, infrequently though it may be. And when they do, well, they're not exhibitionists. They turn off the lights. Hee hee.
Oh, I thought that one was really nice. All good for them.
I know. It's nice to have some time together. Give them privacy. So I made some small contributions to this episode. One of which was to read an article from 2011. Sorry, not an article. A PhD dissertation titled On the Astronomical Knowledge and Traditions of Aboriginal Australians. In which around, I took actual paper notes for this. Here's some Foley. Were you worried?
I mean, a little.
Okay. So the
because
author.
You just came out, you're like, done! And I was like, oh no.
I looked at it. No, I took notes. So there were around 50 Aboriginal Australian groups surveyed, both ethnographic accounts and like extremely sort of colonial ethno histories. And so the purpose of at least the section on, because the dissertation itself focused on all kinds of cosmological events, so comets, yeah, eclipses, meteors, all of that. So,
and that's available in the show notes. It's not, I found a version that wasn't paywalled.
Yeah, thank you.
Like intentionally distributed for, mm-hmm, for public consumption.
No, that's great. Doing the good work. The portion of the dissertation on eclipses was addressing the question, do these groups understand the mechanisms of eclipses? And so additionally, just as kind of an add-on to this, using records of eclipses, Aboriginal records of eclipses to date rock art, because that gives you an absolute date because you can when the eclipse was. So if you can match a specific rock carving to its eclipse, then you can date it. Anyway.
During the Jack Nicholson nod.
Yeah. So understanding the mechanisms of eclipses, just understanding the relative motion of the sun and the moon. I took notes on sort of the overall highlight points. So in broadly in these cultures, and there's going to be exceptions because there were 50 groups surveyed.
Right, exactly.
Yeah. often, but not always, the sun is female and the moon is male. And as with some of the cultural stories, the mythologies that I just referenced, there's often some aspect of pursuit or of just kind of meeting during eclipses, missing each other otherwise. There is a lot of treatment of the moon waxing and waning as either something to do with pregnancy, getting sort of fatter and fatter, or it is related sometimes to as a way to discourage the idea of gluttony. Don't be like the moon. Moon eats too much, gets really round, and then gets sick and kind of wastes away.
Yeah. Oh, wow.
Okay. Yeah. And then where it comes to reactions to eclipses, I'm going to read what the author wrote. I took a couple of excerpts because they did a really good job of providing the caveat that a lot of these accounts came from external perspectives.
Yeah.
And especially sort of the idea of seeing an eclipse as an omen or something negative or being fearful of it. Like I just really, and the author kind of shared these sentiments. I wasn't sure what to take seriously because there is often kind of this infantilizing idea of like, look at these rubes being scared of the sun and moon casting a shadow.
And there's so when a lot you of say that. The author,
I'm sorry. Yes. Dwayne Willis Hammaker II.
Yeah.
Is this from Macquarie University? Is that right? Mm-hmm. Okay.
I think so. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. So I'm going to a quote from Dwayne Willis Hammaker II. Quote, "The following accounts suggest that many Aboriginal groups had a firm understanding that during a solar eclipse, an object was covering the sun, although many explanations were presented as to what that object was and why it covered the sun. Some interpretations presented in this chapter are solid examples of Aboriginal astronomy in that they clearly display an understanding of the motions of the sun and moon and their relationship with eclipses, including those of the Yolngu, who had a clear understanding that the moon covered the sun during a solar eclipse. Other groups, such as the Wurundjeri and the Yulai, acknowledged that something was obscuring the sun during a solar eclipse, although it is not clear whether they defined that object as the moon." And I thought this was great. "Again, it is important to remember that many Aboriginal cultures were heavily damaged by colonization. Most of the records available in the literature are colonist accounts, few of which come from professional ethnographers. Given that Aboriginal societies are extremely complex and exist in a framework that is foreign to most Westerners, I acknowledge limitations in interpreting the available information, which is strongly influenced on the biases, interpretations, and legitimacy of the sources." End quote. So this was a literature review, but Dwayne did a good job of saying, well, this literature is not from this culture, these cultures. Yeah. Also of note when it comes to eclipses is the indigenous cultures in North and South America treat eclipses as part of their own cosmology. And so specifically, I'm pulling from an article in the New York Times that was written about the October eclipse in 2023. So much of this article kind of goes through a lot of the different indigenous groups who have cosmologies and mythologies built around the eclipse, and also just sort of a, hey, readers who aren't indigenous, here's how to go view the eclipse if it is occurring on indigenous land with respect. Some of those guidelines include not touching artifacts. Okay, that makes sense. Removing digital location tags when posting pictures and videos online. I thought that was something I wouldn't have thought of, just sort of unprompted. And staying on designated trails, which makes sense. And the article specifically starts off at Bears Ears, which is now a protected national monument. But
it's run by the government, not by indigenous communities, I believe is the case.
Yeah. And
unless they gave it back. But
I don't think it has been given back. I think because Obama was the one who designated it a a monument.
Oh, it respectfully recognizes their work, that their work is carried out on the traditional lands of the Hopi, Navajo, Zuni, Ute, and other tribes and pueblos. Well, that's nice of them to respectfully recognize that.
Sure. Yeah. At least in the case of this 2023 eclipse, ambassadors were stationed throughout the region to remind people to follow this advice. So the reason is that for the Navajo or Diné, that's what they call themselves. An eclipse it's taboo to look at it. You go inside when an eclipse happens, because it is, it has to do with their sort of origin story. Looking up at an eclipse is believed to disrupt a person's hojo, or spiritual harmony. And so to avoid that, you duck into a structure during an eclipse. And so that is why the sort of respectful thing to do is not to post photos of a particular eclipse, so that people, out of respect for people who want to avoid viewing the event. Yeah. And so each indigenous community has its own beliefs about the eclipse. To some, it's sort of a reset, a rebirth. Mm-hmm. To some, it is something swallowing the sun. It is a bad omen. That is a good perspective to have on eclipses, that they are parts of living culture, mm-hmm. that we shouldn't forget about. We know why eclipses happen. We know how they work, but that doesn't mean that they aren't still important.
Yeah.
Culturally and can be viewed within a culture's cosmology without necessarily like negating anything about the science of it.
I think people can also, perhaps it might be just thinking about conversations I've had about cultural relativism lately with folks. But you think about how one can know that Easter is calculated every year to be the first Sunday after the first full moon after the spring equinox.
That's a mouthful. So, yeah.
But that doesn't change the fact that it has a significance to many people.
Mm-hmm.
And it has a connection to a huge part of how they view the world and their place in it.
Mm-hmm.
And like, but also like, how hard is it to not do the thing they're asking you nicely not to do?
Yeah, they're asking nicely.
I don't know. That's just like, I don't know why that's, yeah.
It's their land.
But let's talk about a couple examples of folks who don't know what's up when it comes to.
Yeah. Quoting Littman and Espinac's recent book, Totality, The Great North American Eclipse of 2024.
They're astronomers. They're like NASA guys.
Okay, great. Quoting the book. On June 16th, 1406, not the future, says an enlightened and bemused French chronicler. Oh, the temptation to do a French accent, but I'm not going to. Between 6 and 7 a.m., there was a truly wonderful eclipse of the sun, which lasted nearly half an hour. It was a great shame to see the people withdrawing to the churches and believing the world was bound to end. However, the event took place, and afterward, the astronomers gathered and announced that the occurrence was very strange and portended great evil. End quote. Is this them too?
Okay. This is a parenthetical. Okay. Yeah.
Half an hour is too long for totality, but the right length for conspicuously reduced light surrounding totality, which is, for people who don't know what an eclipse is necessarily.
So it wasn't like the sun went out for half an hour. Like, no. It wasn't dark for half an hour.
No, it just.
But it was darker for half an hour.
The theater lowered its lights.
Headlines and some YouTube videos about how to explain an eclipse to your dog. Because like it'll stress out your dog, because Fiddle might get really upset.
Oh,
because
she does.
It'll seem like it's stormy.
The sky.
Because it seems stormy. But yeah, so those astronomers that are like, did you just see that? That yeah. was bonkers.
Yeah.
It's like, whoa. You've got one job.
Yeah. Well, maybe they weren't so into public outreach. Or their public outreach was like, something bad's going to happen.
Bad, also, they were bad YouTubers. Rising. They, yeah. They weren't. They didn't do SciComm. They did content creation.
They did creation content. Hey.
Yep. Okay. I get it.
Anyway, this is a trope, though, the idea of sort of people ignorant of science being cowed or intimidated or frightened by an eclipse, and people who do know things tricking those other people into thinking they're magic by deploying a well-timed eclipse. And the example that popped into my head, of course, anyone who knows me will go, ah, yes, is a chapter from A Connecticut Yankee and King Arthur's Court, the novel by Mark Twain. And I will give a very, very brief kind of synopsis of what happens. But it just, man gets knocked on the head real bad and wakes up in King Arthur times and is found by a knight and brought to King Arthur's court where... And it was it's always interesting to me that Merlin in this book is the villain or a villain. But it's Twain. So it's ultimately it's satire of sort of like modern technology. But
man, if there ever were a man that creates Twitter.
Merlin?
No, Twain. Can you imagine?
Oh, OK. Ugh. Oh, yeah. Pithy.
Insufferable.
Probably.
Yeah. So what okay,
so
Merlin,
he's in, our boy is in King Arthur's court trying to explain where he's from, and Merlin takes great umbrage at this and says, hey, I'm the magic guy around here.
Ah, this that is famous a, line.
This guy is
the American bard Twain. Hey.
Hey. And so yeah, so Merlin manages to get the king to throw this guy in jail. And while he is in the dungeon, he is sentenced to be burned at the stake as a witch or a demon or, you know, like consorting with the devil.
Sure.
And while he is in the dungeon, he realizes that there is an upcoming solar eclipse and he thinks it's a day later than it is. So there's a little twist in the chapter that where he's scheduled to be executed a day before he thought he was going to be. And so he just like, oh no, I guess this is going to be a short book, but no, let's see. Let me, oh, I'm going to read a little bit from
oh,
it.
Oh, okay.
I was just
scrolling. You were like looking it up real quick to be like, what happened?
No. I accidentally scrolled past the bit I was going to read. There was a pause and a deeper hush, if possible, and a man knelt down at my feet with a blazing torch. The multitude strained forward, gazing and parting slightly from their seats without knowing it. The monk raised his hands above my head, his eyes toward the blue sky, and began some words in Latin. In this attitude, he droned on and on a little while, and then stopped. I waited two or three moments, then looked up. He was standing there, petrified. With a common impulse, the multitude rose slowly up and stared into the sky. I followed their eyes, sure as guns. There was my eclipse beginning. The life went boiling through my veins. I was a new man. The rim of black spread slowly into the sun's disk. My heart beat higher and higher, and still the assemblage and the priests stared into the sky, motionless. I knew that this gaze would be turned upon me next. When it was, I was ready. I was in one of the most grand attitudes I ever struck, with my arms stretched up, pointing to the sun. It was a noble effect. You could see the shudder sweep the mass like a wave. Two shouts rang out, one close upon the heels of the other. Apply the torch! Merlin. I forbid it! The king. Thus begins the sort of installment of this guy at court. And he becomes really... I mean, spoilers for people who haven't read A Connecticut Yankee and King Arthur's Court. Including but over me. The course of... Yeah. Over the course of the book, this man figures out how to bring modern technology... He figures out basically how to generate electricity, how to create more powerful weapons, and basically ruins Camelot. And that is sort of the extent of Twain's satire. It's just like, man, Modernity sucks. The man who put the H in Jesus H. Christ. Samuel Clemens. Mark Twain.
Huh.
Yeah.
Well, those French astronomers back in 1406 might have been taken by surprise when an eclipse came. But as it turns out, we, and I say we because I am stealing Babylonian valor, have been able to predict eclipses for thousands of years.
What? This whole time?
Okay, Anna is laying down at this point.
I'm not laying.
Yelling from the distance.
I'm not laying down. I'm not laying down. My chair doesn't sit up as I'm reclining.
Okay.
With my lumbar support pillows.
Well, could you take your microphone with you next time you recline? What if you have a take? So when we've discussed ancient astronomy some time ago, I'm pretty sure I made it very clear that I was bad at cuneiform and also bad at math. Well, I seem to have found myself in this situation once again, and I spent a lot of today squinting at a lot of numbers and words in an attempt to craft a punchy narrative, at one point texting Anna, I need help.
I just want to say I was no help with math at all.
No, I had to. No, I lost a lot of time in reading the words and numbers.
Okay. So, and you had to tell me, like, I looked at math and now I'm mad.
That is what happened. If you are a casual listener of The Dirt, you know that Mesopotamians loved to keep receipts, literal and otherwise, and they loved to make lists. Same went for astronomers, who would observe the movements of the heavens, record positions of the planets and other heavenly bodies, and take notes when something out of the ordinary happened. By recording this data year after year and analyzing it in conjunction with events on Earth, such as military victories, royal deaths, plagues, droughts, rebellions, stuff like that, the hope was to establish correlation between these two categories of information to interpret the celestial events as omens. Eclipses, particularly solar eclipses, were a big deal in that arena. And as you could possibly guess from the list of things that I asked about, usually a bad omen.
Yeah, not great.
So over the centuries, Babylonian astronomers, who would later be known as Chaldean astronomers to the Greek writers, to whom a lot of their knowledge was eventually passed down. So Chaldea was the province. So Chaldea is the area that Babylon is in. So that's why they were known as Chaldean. Every 223 lunar months, so the time it takes for the moon to go from no moon to no moon. And that is a little bit more than 18 solar years. So the amount of time it takes us to go around the sun. I have to say solar because there are so many different flavors of year when you're dealing with space math. An eclipse would happen. So it wouldn't be visible to the astronomers every time because it is going around. But each eclipse that they recorded fell in a pattern of a period of 223 lunar months. Does that make sense?
Totally.
Okay.
Yeah.
So this cycle would later be known as the Saros cycle, which is Greek, which is the length of time it takes for the sun, moon, and earth to line up in a syzygy after an eclipse has happened. So syzygy, 223 lunar months, syzygy. The one happening on April 8th, so the great North American solar eclipse, is a part of Saros 139. And so there are a lot of them active. That's why we had one last year. That was a different Saros cycle. So it's not, yeah, okay, great. So that one, the last, its path of totality, last cut across Western Africa, northwest, ultimately through Siberia and China, on March 29th, 2006. So that was the last time that Earth, Sun, Moon were in a straight line to create a total solar eclipse. And it happened that we were, that's how, that was the place on Earth where it passed over.
That makes sense.
So, and oh, good. Okay, great. Great. This yeah. is good. This is that
so far,
was all,
crushing it.
All things that I understood, because now we have an example of tablets. So that's where it went bad for me. An example of tablets recording sorrow cycles is found dating to the Achaemenid period.
What?
Which is the Achaemenid
period. You want the dates?
Well, I mean, just like generally, what's the Achaemenid period?
Oh, sorry. The rise of the Persian Empire.
Yeah. So, yeah. So this
okay.
Is,
sorry. I was like, this, I don't know those dates off the top of my head.
So in the 4th century BCE-ish.
Okay, great.
But it's a chunk of time. And in those tablets, the author has mapped out eclipse possibilities along sorrow cycles. That is where they have, okay, 200. So from this date, 223 lunar months from here, there could be one. And it could be one because it could be on the other side of the planet that you don't know exists yet. Like it, but it also could happen. So there's room for, persuasion
disappointment
of the gods. You know, like there's
oh,
that
I
possibility.
See.
So you have to look for it. You're looking for it. You aren't just like waiting around for one. You're just like, oh, it's coming. And that's when you send a letter to the king and you say,
heads up.
I think that is basically literally what the letter said. And like, because I was trying to find like a pithy like letter to ref, and they're all boring because they're all formulaic. And I'm just like, of like writing letters about there is one. There's the possibility of one this week. It didn't appear. I wrote to the king and said, be aware. the authors of the article that is in the show notes, you can look at the tablets and go, oh. They describe one of them as handsome, which is...
What does that mean?
I'm going to say weird.
Is weird.
Just a good looking chunk of clay.
Real nice profile on that tablet.
The Assyriologists debate the purpose of a document like this, because it's not a record of actual eclipses like what I had talked about they used to ultimately calculate the periodicity.
It's a model. It's a predictive model. Yeah.
It's just a chart. Basically? It's just a spreadsheet. So it's not a record, nor is it a predictor of visible to them eclipses, because it's just,
okay.
But like it, cause it just could be, that doesn't help, because there could be a lot of them. Like, you know, there could be like five a year and you're like, huh. So
gods are mad.
A suggestion that the authors put forward that I really like is that maybe the Babylonian astronomers were laying down a framework for understanding much longer periods of time, like in a chronology, as a way to anchor events in their past or future along the same absolute chronology. So like maybe they were doing that. Maybe they had a deeper sense of history than not. Like maybe that's what this points towards. I don't know. So I like that idea, because also, but also it could just be, we're just looking at the work of another of our neurodivergent siblings who just wanted to keep track. And like,
that's
fine.
That's great.
So either neurodiversity visibility in the archaeological record, or
yeah, let's hear it.
A strong, like a commitment to understanding the depth of history and futurity. Either one, I'm happy with.
A little bit of both.
Por que no las dos. Reference to the sorrow cycle and its 223 month duration is found on the Antikythera mechanism, which
big fan.
Does it date to the second millennium BCE?
Second century BCE.
Wow. Okay. Thank you. So good. I'm glad.
You got time pilled.
Look at me. This is why we need absolute dating. Okay. So the Antikythera mechanism dates to the second century BCE. And it's found. It was found in the Mediterranean off the coast of Antikythera in a shipwreck in 1901, which is in the second millennium CE. So it is an orrery. So an orrery.
Truly. Why would you put that many?
Oh, you know why? Do you know why? Because the first one was, well, the first one that British people cared about was gifted to the, you know, the Earl of Orr or something. It's a British name.
Couldn't have been Sandwich. It couldn't have been the Earl of Sandwich.
So it's an orrery, which is a model that illustrates and or predicts the position of the planets. So the one here in question, Antikythera mechanism, reflected the sun, moon, and the five known planets, known to the Greeks, relative at to the Earth. Yeah. And so it could be used in determining not only eclipses, since we see the number 223, but in Greek numbers. So it says, like, skg, because they use letters as numbers, and it says SKG. That's what it says.
Yeah, I know why you said skg, but it's still funny.
And so not only would it be useful for things like that, but also very important things, like when the next Olympic Games is going to be.
Which
now we
was
just
a massive religious festival, not just
yeah, exactly.
A.
Exactly. Now we just have like NBC Sports to tell us. Nowadays, we, in addition to NBC Sports, we have extremely powerful mathematical models that accurately predict the path of eclipses. But the term Saros is still used for differentiating eclipse cycles.
Well, as luck would have it, the Saros period isn't the only way to predict eclipses. Eclipses? In ancient China, astronomers used a 135-month, roughly 11-year, eclipse period. An eclipse was known as a shi, referring to the act of eating, which something appeared to do to the sun during it. It's a theme.
Yeah.
In listicles and content farm articles, you might come across the story of the earliest recorded eclipse, sometime between 2159 and 1948 BCE, in the court of Zhongkang, during the first dynasty of historical China. There were two astronomers, Xi and He, who, despite having one job, managed to beef it by partying too hard and failing to predict an eclipse. So, quoting from the Shang Shu.
Which is the, like,
quote.
It's a, like, a seminal historical literary text.
Yes. Quote, now here are Xi and He. They have allowed their virtue to be subverted and are besotted by drink. They have violated the duties of their office and left their posts. They have been the first to let the regulating of the heavenly bodies get into disorder, putting far from them their proper business. On the first day of the last month of autumn, the sun and the moon did not meet harmoniously in Fang. The blind musicians beat their drums, the inferior officers galloped, and the common people, employed about the public offices, ran about. The eclipse happened and people got scared?
Yeah, they panicked because they did not know it was happening.
They panicked. The Xi and the He, however, as if they were mere personators of the dead in their offices, heard nothing and knew nothing.
What a burn.
So stupidly, I know. They were snoozing. So stupidly went they astray from their duties in the matter of the heavenly appearances and rendered themselves liable to the death appointed by the former kings. The statutes of government say, when they anticipated the time, let them be put to death without mercy. When their reckoning is behind the time, let them be put to death without mercy. So don't get it wrong, basically, mm-hmm. is the...
Yeah, you have one job. Quote.
Yeah. However, this is a mythological story.
Not history.
And Xi and He are...
I forgot to leave that. Yeah. So it's not history. This is not a thing that happened.
It's included in a historical text, but it is not.
Because this is the first
factual.
Dynasty of China. This is a period where, you're writing much later.
And Xi and He are sometimes conflated into a single being, other times split into six brothers. Their celestial jobs included preventing eclipses, so it's a bit more understandable that drinking on the job would be a fireable offense. The earliest recorded eclipses in China are listed in a text called the Spring and Autumn Annals, which covers eclipses from 772 to 481 BCE, including a total solar eclipse in 709 BCE.
Yeah. So in the Americas, the Maya worked out their own formulae for anticipating eclipses. Rather than following long cycles of time, astronomers observed over years of recording eclipses that there was a risk of a major eclipse only every 5 or 6 lunar months. Because when you have multiple Saros cycles, like you own, so you can kind of
you can kind of relax, and then you're on call like periodically.
Right. Okay. I see.
So also these aren't, they're pretty accurate, and they got more accurate. At one point they had to like change the number because the years had gone by in such a way that it got out of whack. They recalibrated. So the Dresden Codex, a book dating to 1200 to 1250 CE, and of which you can find a digitized copy linked in the show notes, includes like 8 pages of illustrations of eclipses. Cool. So I'm quoting the Littmann and Espinac book again, which was fun book. Quote, each depiction is different.
I'm so envious that you read a whole book.
I didn't read a whole book. I read chapters. And I still had time for Dune. This is because I've been on vacation, remember?
I know. I
just didn't do my job for a week and I read a chapter. I look forward to school. Quote, each depiction is different, but most show the glyph for the sun against a background half white and half black. In 2 of the pictures, the sun and background are being swallowed by a serpent. Leading up to each picture is a sequence of number, a series of 177s ending with a 148. Each sequence adds up to the number of days in well-known 3 to 5 year eclipse cycles. At the end of each burst of numbers stands the giant, haunting symbol of an eclipse, end quote. So, like, they wrote them down. They, like, figured it out.
Yeah.
So you've got, like, all these folks who are, like, figuring it out. So even if it perhaps is a bad omen or is stressful or has some...
You keep track of it.
Yeah. It's something, like, it's not like you're just walking around being like, oh, no! Like, it doesn't... Like it, there is a capacity to not be surprised. Like those French folks. So we've talked.
They didn't keep track of it. They just didn't
keep track of it. They got a real Xi and Ho situation over there.
Xi and Hay?
Oh, well, it depends on which. Yeah. The other. Yeah. I saw it both. Yeah. They're conflated into a single being called Xi Ho. Who is sometimes the mother of the sun and sometimes the charioteer of the sun. So that's also where, like, the point where, like, like scholars were like, I don't know if this is a real thing.
Are you sure?
Yeah. So we've talked a little bit about the many ways people have understood eclipses and a few ways that societies have calculated when they might be able to expect an eclipse. And also, like, I say they might be able, because, like, it could be somewhere else, which that would really, like, think about that, like, where you only have, like, a quite narrow view of the sky, and you're just
how,
like,
big
and you
is.
Still manage to figure it out when you're only seeing it once every, like, rarely. Amazing.
So the power of math.
Don't trust it.
Eludes me.
Yeah. So let's spend the rest of our time looking at a few eclipses that help us pin down events in history, not unlike our Babylonian forebears might have done in their Saros cycle texts.
Yeah. All right. Well, let's hop on our soul cycles.
Oof. Or we could hop on our very agile chariots that we are driving back from not losing to Ramses II.
Fine. Great segue. Let's hop on our segue to talk about Mursili II, the Hittite ruler who was king around 1330 to 1295. Also saw somewhere in the 1320s to 1295. Mm. We know when he died. It's called Mursili's eclipse, and this is a possible solar eclipse mentioned in a text dating to his reign, which could be really great if it pins down part of the absolute chronology of the Hittite Empire, of which he was a leader. So this happened in 1312 BCE. There were 2 dates proposed for this, both earlier in the year and earlier in time, proposed March 14th. It is now thought to be more likely that it was June 24th. The text records that in the 10th year of Mersilia's reign, the sun gave a sign.
Ace of Base, yes.
Opened up their eyes. Just as the king was about to launch a military campaign against another kingdom. So most scholars accept the 1312 BCE event because this eclipse's effects, I love this, would have been particularly dramatic with a near total eclipse over the Peloponnese region and Anatolia, which is where the campaign was happening, around noon. So like the most sunniest mm-hmm. going to the most eclipsiest. Yeah. The other one was around 8:20 in the morning. Too early to make much of an impression. Just start this morning. Feels dark. Anyway, we gotta go fight stormy. The Hittites. Yeah.
Another eclipse that is quite useful in nailing down absolute chronology of the ancient Near East is known as the Bur-Sagale eclipse, which is recorded in the Assyrian Limmu lists. So the
lists.
The what?
Sorry. Lists.
So the Limmu was the official who managed the Akitu festival, so the New Year festival. Mm-hmm. And that year, it was a guy named Bur-Sagale of Gazana. And Gazana is the ancient name for Tel Halaf.
Oh, interesting. Yeah.
So this, I tried to...
Flashback to sophomore year.
Yeah, so thinking about, like, this would... So I was like, if you named it after like the Maid Sylvia of the Forest Festival, like each year, or like also like sure. that this, if you had a Limmu list for San Francisco, maybe it would be like the Grand Marshal of the Pride Parade. So, you know, like
the administrator of the thing,
the administrator of the thing name, is just how them. You know it as. So yeah. this would, yeah. So, maybe like we would have, we would have Limmu lists that are like Bush administration, you know, like that's how we like nail down time. So the entry reads, so it is Bur-Sagale of Gazana, revolt in the city of Ashur. In the month Simanu, an eclipse of the sun took place. That's it. That's it. It's just highlights. So Simanu is the lunar month that falls in May, June-ish. We know where Assyria is. I now have written, when know roughly. So we know roughly when the Neo-Assyrians were doing their thing. Like we have the relative dating. Could that be all the clues, Mr. Policeman? Indeed. There was an eclipse on June 15th, 763 BCE, where the path of totality passed a bit north of Assyria, but it absolutely would have been super dark. This event not only stakes down the flapping tarp of Near Eastern king lists and all that, but it also anchors the reign of the Israelite king Jeroboam II from the Bible. The eclipse is mentioned twice in the Old Testament, once in the book of Amos, where Amos is preaching. He's like at the time of Jeroboam and goes to the Judeans and is like, y'all should repent too. But it also more famously shows up in the book of 2 Kings and might actually be the like kind of root of that trope that you sort of invoked from Twain. Because in the book, in the 2 Kings, Jonah shows up at Nineveh, finally to get the people of Nineveh to repent after the whole thing with the whale, the fish. And he urges them to repent lest the city be destroyed. They all say, nah, I'm good. There is a solar eclipse. And they're like, oh, what was that? And the people repent.
Can you go over the repenting thing again?
So that kind of like yeah. well-timed, using a well-timed, yeah. So
using it to manipulate basically.
Yeah. And so, Hebrew Bible lists that, Jonah prophesied in the kingdom, in the court of Jeroboam, the second, who was the king of Israel at the time. And so by having an exact date
for the eclipse, we have an anchor point.
Regnal dates.
We have an exact point of when an event happened. And so we can mm-hmm. line up. Mm-hmm. Oh, gosh. Ashurdan II. I think that's who the Assyrian king was. And so we are able to line it up. So it doesn't necessarily, like, some we obviously have said that this is, you know, proof that Jonah went to Nineveh and got them to repent. But what it does tell us is that people, the author knew that there had been an eclipse visible at this time in this place. So we have sort of a
people would have talked about it.
Terminus post-quem.
Post-quem. Yeah,
the point after which it could have happened.
It had to have.
Yeah. So I think I thought that one was a fun one because that is one where it because, you know, with the Hittites, we're like, but with this one, it's like, maybe. There it is.
Found it.
Yeah.
Let's talk about the eclipse of Thales. So he was one of the seven sages, a founding figure of ancient Greece, and he was credited with the saying "Nothis auton," know thyself, which was inscribed on the temple of Apollo at Delphi. Many regard him, because Herodotus said so, as the first philosopher in the Greek tradition, using observation and natural philosophy instead of mythology to explain the world. And he is credited by Bertrand Russell in 1945, so other data has become available since then. But he's credited as the first to have engaged in mathematics, science, and deductive reasoning.
Also, wasn't it Isaac Asimov who also was like, that was the moment when science was invented. And he was like, oh, shut up.
Yep. He did say that. It's like, come on, man. The Babylonians. And people before that. And also people before that. Anyway, this eclipse was in May of 585 BCE. And again, according to Herodotus, so we don't know, it was allegedly predicted by Thales, except we don't know that he did that because the only record of it is that Herodotus said so. So according to Herodotus, the appearance of this eclipse was interpreted as an omen and interrupted a battle in a long-standing war between the Medes and the Lydians. And this is referred to as the Battle of the Eclipse. And Herodotus writes that day turned into night and during the battle, and everyone got freaked out and put the war on pause. And this eventually led to the signing of a peace treaty and the end of a years-long war. So,
great. Yeah.
Works out.
So thank you to that man for inventing science. But finally, I want to bring it all back together with an eclipse story that kind of folds in folklore, sort of Western science and like scientism, and that rake that we can't seem to stop stepping on, ignoring indigenous knowledge or sort of seeing it as something else. So in a 1969 article in American Anthropologist, you want to help me out with this name?
Brian Dutoit. Or Toit.
Dutoit.
Fiddle is whining very piteously at my door. I'm going to let her in real quick.
Okay, I'm going to wait.
Okay. Sorry, she's happy now.
Okay, good. In a 1969 article, an American anthropologist, Brian Dutoit, describes an experience in Papua New Guinea during his fieldwork in 1962, in which he was informed by community members that they had been warned by a government official that possibly a colonial, like a kind of administrator.
Was
like an Australian administrator, that the sun was going to disappear for 5 minutes in a couple weeks and that they shouldn't look at it without sunglasses. So the community members began worrying about how to properly prepare for the eclipse, since it would really mean that the sun would disappear for 2 weeks. Dutoit tried to explain the mechanisms at play to calm them down. Also, like the sort of the thrust of the article is very much around like trying to understand, if not prevent, cargo cults, because this is in that moment. But it was like
previous Dirt episode on cargo cults.
Yeah, and just that there was this concern about like millenarian like actions and stuff, and
sure.
So and there's also like the dynamics of missionaries being there and be like, well, we're not worried because we have the Lord, and like kind of exploiting that in like
also this was a musical
uncertainty. So he tried to explain the mechanisms at play, but he also did a suspiciously to them timed bi-monthly supply run that made it look like he came back with like more than he was prepared for more than 2 weeks of darkness. So didn't time it well. Like he and his wife and his small child like went to town and they came back with like
a lot of stuff,
2 months worth of canned goods. And they're like, are you sure?
Hey.
But something that is kind of glossed over in the article, and then I found through a reference elsewhere, sort of reframed, is that the 5 minutes versus 2 weeks of darkness thing wasn't just a matter mm-hmm. of like simple natives or whatever sort of ideas might have been at play. Quoting Dutoit in the article, when the village headman, Opura, told us that it was associated with the problems created by the Tudark, I questioned him about his fears. Tudark is a different word.
I know. It's just like a Tudark. It's just a very...
No. So I questioned him about his fears. Quote, how do you think it is possible for the sun to disappear for 2 weeks? And even if it did, what would that do to you? End quote. He sat down and told me about the ancestors and what had happened when his father was young. Once during those years, it had grown dark, he explained, and the earth was covered with a white powder. Sometime in the past, there was a volcanic eruption in that area of the highlands. The pigs had become vicious, and large wild pigs had come out of the forests. When he was asked what that had to do with the house they were building, he explained that they would all gather in there, the entire village, and that the people were already gathering large supplies of firewood, food, and water in bamboo containers. They feared, he said, that the long period of darkness would result in a repetition of the earlier situation and that the large wild pigs would come down from the forest and attack people. Legit they fear. Also expected the ancestors to return, and they were all going to be waiting for them in the central ceremonial structure. We departed in the late afternoon for Akuna and did not see Opura or anybody from his village until the following week, in spite of the fact that they normally visited Akuna frequently and regularly. So what others had sort of that cited this was that they're mm-hmm. talking about a memory of
a volcanic eruption.
A volcanic eruption, and perhaps of like, what is that? Like the Little Ice Age or something, where there would, if there's if there's a major volcanic eruption, it can disrupt. But we're reading the account of a man who was actively learning the language while doing this work. So was it his literal father's childhood? Was it? Is mm-hmm. it an is it a strong is it a memory, a cultural memory of like an oral historical record of like if it gets dark in the middle of the day, it could be that there was a volcanic eruption, and if you know it's coming, you should probably be prepared because it will disrupt your ability to access clean drinking water, to access food. The animals might freak out because there's a volcano happening. Like, and so I thought that I found this very compelling that this was in the 60s, and this point of like, I think that, you know, I wasn't there. Brian Dutoit knows more about this situation than I do, possibly. But also there is... there is the possibility that he was, his ability to see what might be a form of, indigenous knowledge, was occluded by his concern for,
would you say it was eclipsed by?
Yeah. By his concern for potential like cargo cult activity and like,
yeah.
Like, I think that this story is less about eclipses than about people taking, people responding quite rationally to information that they are given.
Mm-hmm. With, you know, reacting based on what they know has happened before.
Yeah.
Makes sense.
Yeah. So that's what I got. I got a fun little roundup. So if you are stuck at home with your family because your work has canceled because you have an eclipse day, or you are stuck in traffic with people because everybody stopped to look at the eclipse, hopefully the last, you know, hour and 15 minutes has given you enough to come up with something to fill the silence. And also, I wrote this in reaction to some like really badly researched articles that are out there of just being like, well, here's what they say. And I was just like, give me a source. I would like a crumb of source, please. And so I went out and I found some sources.
Thank you. You also promised me a fact about the song Total Eclipse of the Heart, I believe.
Total Eclipse of the Heart, yeah. Turn around. Did you know the original name of the song was Vampires in Love? Because it is a song about vampires in love. The person who wrote it was writing a musical about vampires in love.
Bonnie Tyler was writing a musical?
No, she didn't write the song. She just belted it. Didn't write the song. She made it. So it was, and it was potentially going to be for Meatloaf, which...
That rings a bell.
Which tracks. But more importantly...
Vampires in love.
Like, I looked it up because I was trying to, like, I had this worm in the back of my brain that was telling me something very unsavory about the subject matter of the song that I think I had conflated with the very creepy video. Like, creepy in the, like, implying here of the video?
It is a little creepy.
And I looked it up, and then I was just like, no, I'm sorry. Vampires in love. Because it's just like, well, yeah, if you listen to the lyrics, it's about vampires. They're like in the dark and years have gone by. And I'm just like, I'm sorry. Am I vampire?
I'm also, I also experience both darkness and time.
Yeah.
I'm
just like, you know, I too but I get like a little terrified at the fact that all the years have gone by. Like, yeah.
Turn around.
How can you write something so arresting and beautiful and it be so corny?
The two things can coexist.
But out of corn was forged.
Vampires in love.
Vampires in love. So now every time you hear it, you're just going to be like, I'm talking about a vampire.
I mean, I don't know that I will be entirely like, ah, yes, vampires, but I will just be like, tasty fact. Thanks for listening, everybody. We love you. Goodbye.
Goodbye.